sponsored commercial-free radio. My name is Michael G. Haskins, and it is 11 o'clock on, what is this, a Wednesday, Wednesday morning. And coming up next will be Living for the City with yours truly.
Strong, moving in the right direction, living just enough for the city. His father works some days for 14 hours, and you can bet he barely makes a dollar. His mother goes to scrub the floors for many, and you best believe she hardly gets a penny. Living just enough for the city.
And welcome to Living for the City, which is a program focusing on telling stories, our stories, our perspectives of local communities throughout our area and beyond. If you've lived in New York City for any length of time, you know how difficult it is to get the media to report in some circumstances, not all, but to report about a subject in depth, tell the truth, or even cover an issue. We examine those very issues, especially dealing with the power of the real estate lobby, housing and land use, and not only land use, but as we've been told, as we've been informed over several programs ago, we are including air and water as well. Well, we're going to start with our guests, and they're on the line joining me right now, and I'm delighted to have them here with me. We're going to bring you some sound from a press conference a few days ago. Jillian Jonas, the senior producer here at Living for the City, has been at these press conferences over the past few months, actually since the summertime, and has been having some exchanges with Mayor de Blasio. We'll get to that in a moment, but I don't think any New Yorker would be surprised at this point, well into Mayor de Blasio's second and final term, that the administration is trying to push as many developments and rezonings as it can cram in before he leaves office next year. Pandemic, by the way, be damned. Despite saying publicly earlier this year there wouldn't be sufficient time procedurally for a complex upzoning in Soho and NoHo, and despite months of silence on the subject, the mayor changed course completely in October and announced that, in fact, they would be trying to get this through. And according to opponents, it is so much worse than anticipated. With me to discuss this, our longtime friend, Andrew Berman, the executive director of Village Preservation, formerly the Greenwich Village Society for Historical Preservation, and Sean Sweeney, longtime director of the Soho Alliance. Welcome to you both.
Thanks so much for having us.
Absolutely. Sean, you with us as well? Okay, fantastic. So before we launch into several questions that I have for you, I would like to just hear a little bit of the exchange that Jillian had with the mayor just recently. So let's go to that first.
I wanted to start with a question along the lines of my previous question regarding the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, which I'll have to get back to another time. The Soho rezoning, this is also a landmark or protected area and a tourist attraction. Opponents say you can have an affordable housing mandate without having to upzone, as other cities have done, without further destroying New York City architecture and history and inevitably causing gentrification with the 75% luxury apartment standard, and thus changing the entire character of the area. And where does your relationship with Edison Properties factor into the plan, which you said earlier this year couldn't be done because of time constraints before your term ends next year?
So a lot of pieces there. Let me try and give you a simple, straightforward answer. I disagree with the analysis that says SoHo is going to gentrify. I think it is extraordinarily gentrified right now. And the whole idea is to introduce affordable housing into a neighborhood that has had very, very little. When you talk about a mandate, obviously I need to know more specifically what you mean, but we've looked at all sorts of tools that actually create affordable housing and came to the conclusion that mandatory inclusionary housing was the way to go, that we think rezoning's done the right way, produce a lot more affordable housing, and that you can depend on it being produced compared to other strategies. So to me, this is about taking a neighborhood that is thoroughly gentrified, that doesn't have an opportunity for folks lower incomes to live there, and creating that opportunity. And originally, it wasn't clear to me whether there would be enough support to move this quickly through the council. I now believe that there is that support, and we want to get this done. Go ahead.
Thanks. I'll have to follow up on that another time, because the second part of my question has to do with the small businesses, New York City small businesses, who are suffering immeasurably right now because of the pandemic. And many won't survive or have already closed. So why is the city even considering any way to facilitate big box stores to proliferate as the upzoning currently does when they clearly don't need help? There are now two targets in the East Village alone and will invariably push out the last few independent small businesses that managed to survive.
Well, let me just clarify, Jillian. You're saying big box stores in terms of the SoHo, NoHo rezoning?
Yeah.
I appreciate the question. I would say, first of all, I haven't had the impression that that's a likelihood in that area, but fair question. I think the bigger problem in that area is what we've seen in a lot of Manhattan retail of all kinds starting to decline rapidly. This was a problem before the pandemic. I talked about it in the State of the City back in the beginning of the year. This is a growing problem now. So the notion that the restrictions currently in SoHo, NoHo really inhibit retail, and that's not good. We're losing a lot of retail. We have to address it. That's part of what's motivating this, is to make sure we do have a strong retail sector still in Manhattan and all the jobs that go with it. I don't believe it is a contradiction, as you present it, between big box stores and smaller stores. Right now, I think retail in general is getting undermined in much of Manhattan, and we need to find ways to preserve all of it. So I don't have the impression it plays out the way you're saying on several levels. I do know if we don't do something different, well, we're going to see a declining retail sector, and that's not good for this city.
And so that was an exchange that senior producer for Living for the City, which this program is, by the way, I'm Michael G. Haskins, Jillian Jonas had with the mayor. So we're going to get right into our guests who are with us right now for their impressions of that exchange and some other questions that I'd like to ask them. Comprehensive questions that Jillian has for the mayor on these areas, and I so appreciate that, putting WBAI out there. Andrew, so let's start with you. Begin with a little history of this particular rezoning, unless you want to just jump in and talk and anything address
sure.
Any of the questions, the comments that the mayor had with Jillian.
Yeah, you know, it's almost hard to know where to begin with the mayor's comments, you know, how much of it is sort of outright lies or misrepresentations and how much is ignorance. But let me first of all say this. So you know, it's very clear to us that what this is about and what it's been driven by from the beginning is not affordable housing or creating a healthy retail environment, which there's ways of addressing, which we would embrace and support, and which we've made very clear that we would embrace and support, as would others in the neighborhood. It's really about the upzoning, which means giving away these giant bonanzas to real estate developers, many of whom have made generous campaign contributions to the mayor over the years and to his, you know, ethically tarred, now shuttered campaign for One New York, who have been lobbying for these changes for years and who really initiated and pushed for this process to begin. So what the mayor is saying is they want to upzone these neighborhoods, allowing new development that's as much as 2.5 times the size of what's allowed there now. And what's allowed there now is pretty big. Mm-hmm. There have been 60 buildings built in these two tiny neighborhoods in the last couple of years, and some of them are as big as 300 feet tall or greater.
Hold on, they Andrew. Say that again. I don't want that to go past people. How many buildings in this past few years?
60 have been built in SoHo and NoHo over the last several years, and the biggest of them exceed 300 feet tall in height, you know, approximately 30 stories. They're saying they want the zoning to change in some areas to allow new buildings that are as big as 2.5 times the size of that. And the give back to the public is a small percentage of the new housing that would be created would be quote unquote affordable. It would either be on site or they would just pay into a fund and it could be built somewhere else. What we've been saying is we would absolutely embrace a mandate where new construction in the neighborhood, it would be required that affordable housing be a component of the new building. And we would embrace it being a higher percentage affordable than what they're talking about. And we would embrace it being deeper affordable, meaning for people of even less means than what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. But we don't embrace the upzoning, which, again, is just the giveaway to the developers. Other cities have put this kind of mandate in place. Other cities have required new residential development in their neighborhoods to include a certain percentage of affordable housing across the board without making it dependent upon these giant giveaways to the mayor, to the developers,
right.
But our mayor has refused to consider that. And as you can see from the way he answered Jillian's question, he wouldn't even address that.
Right. Andrew Berman, and what makes this so much worse than you expected, or has it?
Yeah, I mean, I never would have guessed that they would propose this massive of an upzoning. As I said, almost 2.5 times the size. And again, he's been completely disingenuous about this issue of big box chain stores. Has he ever been to SoHo? You know, that's what's been proliferating in that neighborhood in the last several years, in spite of the fact that the rules don't actually allow it. What they want to do is basically open the floodgates to allow big box retail stores to locate here with very, very little restriction, which is just going to push out the remaining little guys. It's definitely not going to make for a healthy retail environment, but it is what the developers and the big property owners who've been pushing for these changes want, because that's what's most profitable to them. Mm-hmm. It's not what's best for New York City or for SoHo and NoHo. It's what's best for a few well-to-do developers, bottom line.
And Sean Sweeney, I'm going to come to you in a moment, but I want to stay on this with Andrew for just another moment. This, by the way, is Living for the City, and I'm Michael G. Haskins. We're at 99.5 FM WBAI, WBAI.org on the web. Andrew Berman, a key objection is the so-called affordable housing element. For a myriad of reasons, including that you maintain the city can still build such housing without having to upzone a predominantly historic area. Explain that for us.
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, as I said, there's been a ton of construction in SoHo and NoHo over the last several years. Mm-hmm. If the city had already done this, imagine if each one of those 60 buildings had 25% of their space set aside for affordable housing. Going forward, that's something that the city could and should do, but is refusing to even discuss or consider or put on the table. The other route that they could also go is, you know, most of the housing in Soho is actually not new construction, but these old manufacturing and industrial buildings that have been converted to residential use over the years. The city could similarly require, when those kinds of conversions take happen, a certain amount of the space needs to be set aside for affordable housing without there being any kind of upzoning attached to it. Mm-hmm. They're refusing to do that. And I want to make one last point on this affordable thing. So the way this plan is structured, it's 100% market driven. So there's no guarantee whatsoever that even a single unit of affordable housing will ever get built. The only time anything gets built is if and when the developer who owns the private property says, you know what, now's the time, it fits my bottom line to build here, and I'll build, and under the existing mandates, I'll build a gigantic building with a small percentage of affordable housing in it. If they're not feeling like the market is supporting their moving forward, they're not going to build, and nothing is going to get built. And frankly, that's what's happened with most of the rezonings that the city has done around the city. They've produced little or no affordable housing because they're 100% dependent on the market.
Mm. Thank you, Andrew. Sean Sweeney, director of Soho Alliance, it's been reported the mayor is trying to play, quote, the race card, unquote. You heard his response about gentrification. What's really going on here from your vantage point?
Well, first of all, gentrification implies that the gentry, the wealthier people, are displacing the poorer people. That was never the case in Soho. When I've been living here since 1976. There were no people living here at that time to displace. It was all factories and warehouses. And we created this neighborhood out of the wilderness. We were pioneers from the urban wilderness. We had displaced no one. We built Soho. Then it became popular, and some rich people did move in here. And now people think, wow, this is full of wealthy people. However, I know hundreds and hundreds of people who are living in rent-stabilized apartments, former lofts that were converted under the loft law, and their rents are paying $500, $1,000, maybe $1,500 a month. Me and a bunch of other artists bought a very small building here in 1981, and my current maintenance is $1,000 a month. That's affordable. But de Blasio is saying there's little or no affordable housing. That's an outright lie.
And this will push those residents out, right, Sean?
Yeah, of course. Of course. It'll gentrify it more. It'll bring in a more fancy. I mean, there's nowhere to shop here. You know where we have to shop? We've had to shop at Dean and DeLuca. You know what they charge for an onion? The nearest store is Whole Foods.
Yeah, yeah. Sean,
I know. Can I just go back about?
Sure.
Affordable sounds great.
Yes,
oh,
yes, it does.
But if you really look at what this mandatory inclusionary housing, his program, it's not for the poor or the working class. Mm-hmm. The Soho Alliance has come out for 100% affordable housing for the working people and the essential workers. People earning minimum wage. For instance, there was a studio apartment under his plan in Hell's Kitchen where the minimum income was $69,000 minimum to get a one studio. In Long Island City, there is another project where you could get a three-bedroom apartment for $5,500 a month and earn $269,000, over a quarter of $1 million a year income, and you apply and you're available under this program. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
In other words, people who are earning minimum wage would not be could not qualify under his minimum mandatory inclusionary housing. So it is not for the poor. It is not for the working class. It's for the gentry.
Well, you're making my head hurt with those numbers, but it's something that we know all too well here in New York for the past several years. These things, we've heard these numbers and people paying these exorbitant amounts of money for apartments, and it's just out of the realm for regular New Yorkers or somebody, as you say, Sean Sweeney, someone that has a minimum wage job or works at $15 an hour. I'm speaking with Sean Sweeney, director of Soho Alliance. and Andrew Berman, Executive Director of Village Preservation. And this is WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Andrew, you recently wrote an op-ed calling the rezoning a Trojan horse and what is a false narrative dichotomy. Please explain that for our listeners.
Sure. I mean, so to give you an illustration, we've been pushing this administration for 5 years now, and I've talked about it on this show, to do a rezoning of the neighborhood directly to the north of this, what we call south of Union Square. And we asked for affordable housing provisions in the zoning so that new construction would be affordable. And, you know, one of the arguments that the city gives for their proposed Soho NoHo rezoning is that the existing zoning is about 50 years old, and they say it's very out of date. We shouldn't be using this old zoning. And admittedly, the zoning is imperfect. No zoning is ever perfect. The zoning for the area to the north is 60 years old, so it's even more out of date. And we asked for affordable housing and other updates to the zoning that reflected how the neighborhood have changed over the last half century or so. The city adamantly refused to consider it because we didn't call for a massive upzoning. So what this is really about is not the affordable housing. It's about the upzoning. And that's why groups like Edison Properties, who own the two biggest development sites in the neighborhood in both NoHo and SoHo, although they're not alone in this regard, have been donating generously to the mayor's campaign. And they've also been funding some of the nonprofit groups that have been pushing for the rezoning as well, and who haven't disclosed that some of their board members or funders are actually property owners in the neighborhood who would make a killing off of this. If the real desire, and we still extend this sort of offer to the city, if the real desire is to push ahead with something that would create affordable housing, let's do that. And we can do it in a way that doesn't require destroying the scale and character of the neighborhood, doesn't require giving away the store to the big developers and the big real estate interests, and doesn't involve opening the floodgates to giant chain retail stores, which I don't know what that has to do with affordable housing, but it's part of this plan as well.
Mm. And Sean Sweeney, as we prepare to wrap up our conversation this morning with the two of you, Sean Sweeney and Andrew Berman, city government has been rife with conflicts of interest, particularly going back to the Giuliani days. But it's taken on a new life during the Bloomberg and de Blasio administrations. And yes, often it has to do with personal aggrandizement and making money, which hasn't always been the case. The conflicts here are really notable. And would you speak to that? Do you see them as such, that these conflicts are notable?
Well, what kind of conflicts do you mean? Monetary or?
All across the board. Pick one, please.
Yeah. Well, I'll go back I'll go back 30 years when Broadway had every store on Broadway was wholesale only, and then these retail stores began to move in without the proper permits. So we decided to try to figure out why this was happening, and apparently Mr. Law and Order Giuliani's buildings department, the slightest of evidence would say, oh, it's been retail. For instance, I had a leather company at the time, a leather company. We'd buy wholesale leather on Broadway, and the store had a Xerox machine. You put 10 cents in, you get a Xerox. Giuliani said, oh, that's retail. So that store was grandfathered retail. And one guy claimed to have produced a 1960s brochure open to the public, one day a year sale. Oh, that was grandfathered. And I'll tell you something else. I heard from a former a member of the Board of Standards and Appeals that when we were fighting another luxury development going up on Houston Street, that Giuliani would fax the Board of Standards and Appeals how to vote. And at the end of the day, that fax would be shredded. So So Mr. Law and Order was really not Mr. Law and Order, if that's a surprise to anyone listening. That's one conflict.
Yeah, it is not. Go ahead, Andrew, did you want to respond in any way? Because if not...
Just that, it's sort of sad to see our, supposedly progressive mayor basically continuing in that tradition. And as Sean knows, we've seen that it's really been the big real estate interests that have been behind this push. And, I've often compared, and it's a bit of a broad comparison, but I think an apt one, this kind of approach to the Trump tax cuts. So, the Trump tax cuts, 99% of the beneficiaries were the 1% of the 1%.
That's right.
But there was a little bit that was given to the middle and working class in some circumstances, and that was sort of the fig leaf to get it through. It's the same thing here. This is giving away the store to the developers with this fig leaf of a small amount of affordable housing, which, by the way, is not guaranteed for even a single unit of it to ever be built. And as you said, in some cases, it could be for actually people of pretty significant means. I think in some cases, up to 130% of the average income in the New York City metropolitan area. That's pretty well to do. So it's really a piss poor approach. It's also just not really necessary. These are neighborhoods that embrace the idea of equity and affordability and accessibility, and we would love to work with our city government to implement such a plan, but not one that involves these crazy upzonings and that gives away everything to developers on the basis of who's given the biggest contributions to the mayor.
Well, yes, go ahead.
The Real Estate Board of New York has strongly come out in favor of this. They want unlimited resales. The Real Estate Board of New York, REBNY, the city's largest real estate owners, property owners, landlords, and developers. They're in favor.
Right. No friend of affordable housing, and that tells you everything you need to know about what's really behind this plan.
Absolutely. Let's finish up with some contact information for you both. Let's start with you, Sean Sweeney.
We're on the web at SoHoAlliance.org, and we have a hotline. You can call us for any questions at 212-353-8466, 353-8466, or SoHoAlliance.org.
SoHoAlliance.org. And Andrew Berman, contact information for you, please.
Sure. We have a new website. It's villagepreservation.org. So just go to villagepreservation.org. If you go to our old website, gdshp.org, it'll forward you there. And lots of information about how you can get involved in this campaign as well as other efforts.
All right. Well, thank you both for joining us on Living for the City today on WBAI. We'll be watching these issues very, very closely, and I'm sure calling on you in the not-too-distant future. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
All right. So that is Andrew Berman, as you heard, Executive Director of Village Preservation, and Sean Sweeney, the Director of SoHo Alliance. And we're going all over the city looking at all of these areas and all of these issues because they're where you live. Did you hear what Andrew said earlier? 60 buildings in the past few years in that small little area, SoHo, NoHo. We're going to keep on this each and every program. Jillian Jonas, the senior producer for Living for the City, and myself, I'm Michael G. Haskins. We'll be back with more. Earl Caldwell will be joining us in just a few moments, and we're going to be looking at, well, what we're all talking about and thinking about, the not yet decided election, the major election that has had all of us have our rapt attention for not just the past 24 hours, it seems like years, and it certainly has that. We will be back here on Living for the City on WBAI. I want to take you back just a little bit.
The sounds of the Asian Dub Foundation.
Yes, yes. I swear to fulfill, to the best of my ability and judgment, this covenant.
Taking us back to some of the programs, some of the theme songs from programs past and current here over WBAI, and I thought I'd like to share a little bit of that nostalgia with you today. This is Living for the City over WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. My name is Michael G. Haskins. I'm the host of the program. Jillian Jonas, senior producer with me, has been for 6 years, and I so appreciate everything that Jillian Jonas has done, bringing so much to this program. And you, those of you listening right now, and I can't say this enough of what you have done over the years, not just for this program, certainly not. I've been around for a while here and been on different locations, different times of day, and you have supported my efforts, be it in the early morning or in the afternoon. You have done so, and I appreciate it. Just had contact with a listener just a couple of days ago. Let me know that this listener had made a very generous contribution for this program, in fact, and I so appreciate that. I'm not going to mention any names because I haven't gotten permission to do so, but I want to say thank you in the name of Living for the City. And with that, if you have a mind, please consider becoming a sustaining member. This should be part and parcel of every program. I don't know why it's not or how it's, you know, somehow slip through the cracks. But every program needs to do this at about this time. What do you think? Halfway through the program, to ask for your support. We're listener sponsored and we're commercially free. So if you can, if you're able to make that contribution to WBAI for Living for the City, give us a call now at 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. From Hampton University in Hampton, Virginia, we're joined now by Earl Caldwell, the longtime New York City journalist, author, broadcaster, and friend, even more so. Earl, good morning, and welcome back to the WBAI microphones.
Good morning, Michael T. So nice to be with you.
Thank you so much for having, for being with me, for being with all of us. Earl's an American journalist. For those of you who don't know, you may not remember Earl from the heyday, and I don't want to take a lot of time doing this, but Earl, I think it's important. Earl's an American journalist. He documented the Black Panthers from the inside in 1969 and became embroiled in a key U.S. Supreme Court decision clarifying reporters' rights. The case started when the FBI tried to press Earl Caldwell to be an informant against the Black Panther Party. He worked for the New York Times, the New York Daily News, the New York Amsterdam News, and for a time, he was the host of the Caldwell Chronicle here in the afternoons on WBAI. Earl, let's get right into it. How do you explain the results we've gotten so far from yesterday's election?
Well, Michael, one of the things that comes through, just busts right through, is that the enthusiasm in this election was really Trump's people had the enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
We call it by other names, but it's a reflection. I mean, some of it's law breaking, just doing reckless, crazy things, but they're very much engaged in this thing. There is something that they see that they are fighting for, that they believe is within reach. The Democrats, let me say this. In my class at Hampton University, I had my students in this semester. I said, look at these major issues, climate change, the Black Lives Matter, this COVID thing that's got such a grip on it. And I want you to put it all in the context of this election. And we went through the semester on this stuff. Da, da, da. By the time we got to these debates, I knew something was not connecting.
Hmm.
They were talking about two old white men. I'm saying, wait a minute, are you putting Biden up in there? Hey. These students, these young people, they don't know Biden. They don't. Mm-hmm. They don't go back. They, and then they hear about the crime bill and stuff. They didn't connect with Biden.
And not only that. We talk about this often. The Democrats came late to the party with their ground game in terms of the Latino vote, particularly the Latino vote. I'm hearing reports that, you know, they only came around a couple of months before this election season started heating up rather than making this personal. I heard this morning, this personal connection with voters in any particular area.
And Michael G., let me just get back to that. And it's important. The Democrats believe, and they say, that's a minority. They think they get those votes automatically.
Mm.
They think of the Latin vote the same way they think of the black vote.
Yeah.
It automatically belongs to us.
Mm-hmm.
In New York City, Felipe Luciano for years, was trying to school people here about the Latin. He said, you know, within the Latin families, there's so much racism.
Mm-hmm.
They hate people in their own family because they're different colors.
They have many colors in their family.
And the Democrats, like, they don't know that. They don't know. And so they're not out there. They think it's going to drop on their doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
Drop on your doorstep because a lot of the Latins, they're not like the blacks that were put on this welfare and given this welfare mentality through so many generations. They've come from places where they believe that they can start their own business. They can do these things. They can reach and get these things. And so they are drawn to the Republican Party. I hate to say it, but the leadership at the very top is just from the get go, it was not there.
Hmm.
And I'm sure, you know, I don't want to get into just running any individuals down, but it's like they didn't have. They thought they had a pat hand on it.
Yeah.
Trump.
Right. I mean, you know, speaking of fractures within one's own family and one's own community, right in El Barrio where I live, there's a senior citizen home, and there is prominently displayed a Latinos for Trump right up in the window. Right next to the Puerto Rican flag. So, I mean, you know, you are correct, and Felipe was as well. Earl, a lot of Democrats were not just thinking victory. They were thinking landslide. How did we miss the mark and by so much?
But here's the thing. You know, 50, 60 years ago it was. A governor of Alabama, George Wallace, did what Trump did. He put his ran for president he's running as a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
When he won everything in the South, he came up to Maryland, and he was running away with the primary in Maryland. The only thing that stopped him was an assassin's bullet.
Yeah, yeah.
Racism runs deep in America.
It's deep.
I don't believe. I hate to say it. It hurts me to say it.
Yes.
I'm not sure this country is capable of shedding that. It's too ingrained. It's too much of it there. When they start talking about a landslide, it's like saying, well, they'll come to us. They have no place to go. Enthusiasm matters.
Mm-hmm.
I love Joe Biden. I love him. I feel it's because for a lot of reasons. I find my students don't even know him and don't care about him. Democratic Party has to. When you're 77 years old, you cannot. You don't have the energy. You just can't do it. I felt so sorry for Biden during the debates. There were arguments he should have been making. He should have just been rolling. But he can't marshal his thoughts and express them the way that he could as a young man.
Yeah.
You cannot run and have a good national campaign and win a landslide if you don't have, you got to campaigns are about poetry. You got to grab your people and inspire them and show them something. And then you can start thinking about that. The Democrats could not do that because they weren't prepared to do it.
Earl Caldwell is my guest here on Living for the City. This is WBAI at 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web, and I'm Michael G. Haskins. Earl, Biden can still win the White House, wouldn't that be enough if the Democrats were to get just that?
But here's the thing, Michael. When you say that the Democrats were thinking landslide, they were also thinking they're going to get the Senate.
Yeah.
They're going to increase their majority, and none of that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Biden he could get the White House, but he will be like Obama. Obama got the Affordable Care Act in that little window where he had the House and the Senate when he first got there.
Right, just right.
He lost that right away.
Right away.
He couldn't get anything except what Trump gets off. When Nancy Pelosi became Speaker, he couldn't get anything but those little regulations that he puts out himself that don't mean anything. Next president come around, knock it right out.
Yeah.
I just don't. I don't see a path for the Democrats because the aim was so high. The need is so great. We are in a crisis that I don't even believe people understand how deep it is. With this virus, one of the things a lot of people on the Republican side are looking at is, well, wait a minute, this is only killing blacks and old people and some very poor people, and we can live with this. Just let it run its course. Mm-hmm. Just let everybody get it. Because it's not going to really hurt most of us. There's things that are happening, and there is no, this country cries out for leadership. There is no hope. There is no, it's hard to see the path to the light. And as Fauci said, we're going to go through a dark winter now. And the thing of it is that white Americans will not live. They will tear this country apart if they do not have jobs and income, because they know you cannot live without a job or
not
income.
Not in America, yeah.
Not in America. Yeah. But black people have been on this been brainwashed with this idea that, well, you can get the welfare and somebody's on the, somebody's going to do something. No, if you must do it. So white people are ready to say, okay, we'll fight. You open up these businesses and let us do business. And Biden was caught and then tagged. Well, first thing he's going to do is shut everything down.
Yes.
And the country had already been down. You know, this is the first generation, really, since World War II. Because World War II, everybody had to get involved. Vietnam wasn't quite like that. But this is the first time in a long time that the country has had to have everybody get on board with something. But one of the things that's missing, Michael, is the media. It used to be that you had a media that everybody got the same news, basically. Nothing at the same time, but you got the same thing when it came out to your... Now... You don't even know what it. You have to be something of an expert just to understand what we have now. Whether is this real or is this fake?
Absolutely.
I'm looking at that. Real or fake?
That's right. And that's what the president, who has the ultimate bully pulpit, has been saying for years now. And you cannot put that genie back into the bottle. You cannot say, "Well, I'm not going to cover him." We're covering him constantly, every moment of every day. So we cannot put that genie back in the bottle.
Earl, and he knows how to play it like yes. a charm, too.
Yes, yes.
He?
Earl, where are we? So let's look at this. Where are we now in America? Where are we as a country? I think you painted part of that picture about 5 minutes ago. It is distressing, but I think it's accurate. It's what I said last night when I was talking to Ginger. I said race. That's the issue. W.E.B. Du Bois said it in the 20th century, and it's sure enough, 2020, in 2021, it's the same thing. Where are we as a country?
Well, Michael, the only thing, and when I was trying to think about this also, the only time I've seen anything recently was just after Ferguson thing out there with the policeman on his neck and the way he killed him, the response. It was young people, white, black, brown, from coming from all different places. I believe the future belongs to the young, but the young have to be in a position now to be decision makers. This generation that's here, the core of Trump's generation, you know, they're not young people. These people are old. I believe that the future is somehow we have to pass the torch to a new generation. And if you look at the leader, we got to one man 77, the other 75. Mitch McConnell, it looks like he's 95, and he's deciding what we're going to do and what we're not going to steal. No, what we're going to steal and what we're not going to steal. Mm-hmm. When they steal these Supreme Court justices, they're stealing part of the future from this young generation. And the people who are in this young generation, by the way, you know that the group of four women in the House called a squad, they all won their re-election
yesterday. Yes.
And one of the things is in that House of Representatives, and I love Nancy Pelosi. She's been a great strategist, and she's been a servant through many years. But I wouldn't even be surprised if the House of Representatives comes back and it falls into disarray, because these young voices must be heard. One of the things, even Bernie Sanders, my godson, I was talking to him, and he was saying the BNB. I'm thinking he's talking about Biden. He said, I said, Biden won 20. He said, no, Bernie. Bernie touched a chord.
Yeah,
these other people, they're not touching a chord. But Bernie's touching a chord because people say he can do the impossible. He could make real these things. Trump took blows. I mean, Biden took blows because Trump painted him as a socialist.
Mm-hmm.
Medicare for all resonated with a lot of people in the United States. And if Trump intended them to have any health insurance, they'd already have it. But he doesn't care about that.
No, hadn't put any bills forward, and the Republicans are not interested in that. Earl, in the remaining time, I kind of want to end on a positive note, but, you know, it's the note we're going to end on. It doesn't matter whether it's positive or no. What do we have now to fear? Just fear itself, or are we looking at some things we do? Do we need to fear?
Yeah, Michael. Yes, because we're a country that we have such a close relationship with violence. And we are just, and these things that we're dancing around, I mean, violence is you see the young kid, what was he, 16 years
17,
old out there in Wisconsin,
yes,
and he comes in with all these kinds of weapons, the kinds of things that we have out there. That's something to fear. It's something to fear when, as Fauci says, we're going into this dark winter. People are saying, oh, this will be Trump, it's right around the corner, right around. This could be on us for who knows how long, and because everything is so politicized, if we get a vaccine, I don't even believe I would want to take it. We've got so many things that are so real, and we do not have the media that we all can trust. We don't have it. Everybody says, well, Fox News is propping up all Trump's thing, blah, 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 and yes, they are. But, you know, the other side is you got MSNBC.
Yes.
We're just going to, everybody over here is good, and everybody over there. No. There is right now, really, there is no United States of America.
Mm.
It's just like Obama said when he first came in. He said that, what the great speech that propelled him to the presidency. And his argument was, we're not red states and blue states. We're United States. And the fact of the matter is, we are this collection of states. We've never been what the dream of this country. We've never been able to match it. And there could be great consequences now.
Yes, it could. Earl Caldwell, I so appreciate your time this morning talking to us about these issues the day after the, not midterm, but, the election of 2020. Donald Trump and Joseph Biden. We'll see how this plays out, who wins Wisconsin and who wins Pennsylvania and a couple of other states, but there's a lot at stake, Earl. There's a lot at stake.
Yeah.
I've got to run. Anyway, is there a email address that you'd like to give out now before I run, or some way to contact you down there at Hampton?
They got you to do it. Call Hampton University or write me a letter and say, Earl Caldwell, Hampton University Journalism School.
There you go.
Michael, one quick thing.
Quickly.
And I'm with you, living for the city, but we've got to get some support for these cities that have been through so much, and they don't want to give the cities a dime.
Yes. Yes, I agree.
Nice to be with you, Michael G.
Okay, thank you so much. Earl Caldwell here on WBAI. Once again, it is always my pleasure to welcome Earl Caldwell from Hampton University, Hampton, Virginia. Journalist, author, broadcaster, and friend. The news is upcoming next over WBAI.
Undecided. All eyes are on Pennsylvania and its 20 electoral college votes. As of this hour, Trump holds a lead with 500,000 votes, but more than 1 million votes remain uncounted due to a large number of mail-in ballots. In a press conference this morning, Pennsylvania state officials asked for patience as they work through the count, which could take weeks. The counties where the largest portion of votes have yet to be counted include Philadelphia, the state's most populous county, where Biden leads by 53 percentage points. In other states too close to call, the Associated Press shows Biden with narrow leads in Michigan, Nevada, and Wisconsin, which would bring him a total of 32 electoral votes. Trump is leading in Georgia, North Carolina, which would bring him 31 additional electoral votes. Some of these states are so close, they could result in mandatory recounts. In what could be the highest turnout rate since 1900, if Trump does win the Electoral College, the U.S. may once again have a president in the White House who did not win the popular vote. According to the Associated Press, Biden currently holds a popular vote lead of 2.5 million votes. In the early hours of today, with hundreds of thousands of votes left to count, the president prematurely declared victory and threatened that he'd go to the Supreme Court to, quote, stop all voting. However, it is unclear exactly what Trump will be able to challenge, as vote counts routinely continue beyond Election Day and states largely set their own rules for when the count has to end. Biden's campaign manager, Jen O'Malley Dillon, said she called the president's speech outrageous, unprecedented, and incorrect, and said the campaign is ready for a legal fight. Democrats are on track to maintain a firm hold on the House of Representatives, whereas Republicans are expected to maintain their majority in the Senate. In notable ballot measures, California passed Proposition 22, which means drivers in the gig economy will be classified as independent contractors and exempt from protections like minimum wage and health insurance. It's a big win for Uber and Lyft, and a defeat for labor unions. And New York Attorney General Letitia James has launched an investigation following reports that an estimated 10 million robocalls were sent to U.S. voters in an attempt to encourage them to stay home on Election Day and to generally sow disinformation about voting, issuing subpoenas to understand the source of the alleged disinformation attempts. James stressed that those responsible will be held accountable to the fullest extent of the law. And as of today, the U.S. officially has left the Paris Agreement, 3 years after President Trump announced he would leave the International Climate Change Forum. The accord is a collective agreement among nearly 200 countries that aims to prevent the Earth's temperature from rising 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial revolution temperatures. That's the value that climate scientists have determined will have disastrous consequences if exceeded. The rise could result in rising sea levels and more extreme weather events, such as hurricanes, drought, and wildfires. This, in turn, could lead to mass migration and shortages in food production, according to experts. Joe Biden has vowed to re-enter the U.S. into the agreement should he be elected president. And while Americans voted, the U.S. recorded over 1,100 coronavirus-related